Like Mint, as usual, I like to take the time to welcome my guests, and that way by which I welcome them is to honor them for their time. Time is one of the most precious commodity given to us. It is such a beautiful thing. I misused it, did not understand the value of it when I was a young'un. And as I started getting older and realized how precious she is, how I had to learn how to honor her, respect her. And as I did, she also honored me. The other was and is the journey. The journey is a powerful force because it created the individual before us. And today I have Dr. Joy Bracey to come and talk to you and I, because she is going to give us wisdom, knowledge, insight, so that we can become better human spirits while we occupy this beautiful place that is called Earth. Welcome, Dr. Threads of Enlightenment.
Thank you for having me.
It is an honor to have you here. And tell the folks, how do you serve? I usually ask them that, the guests, that question, because I want the listeners to learn that they have to step outside of self. And the purpose of the journey is so that we can serve. And so how do you serve mankind?
Well, I was born as a helper. I feel that I was born into the world to help my parents and learn to help other people. I helped in school. I was always just wanting to help people. And in some ways, it was a little bit part of my growth that I had to grow out of the mindset, because I was so focused on my value coming from what I could do for others. Mm-hmm. So I had to find this balance of serving others, but I also had to put myself in that realm. Yeah. But it started from the beginning. But as an adult, I have my master's in counseling. I'm a licensed professional counselor. And I've worked for about 20 years or so in the addiction treatment and mental health field, in nonprofits, helping the most vulnerable members of our community, women and children mostly. And then for the past almost 12 years, I've been the CEO at a nonprofit addiction treatment center. So that's what I do as my big career job, so to speak. And then additionally, I teach self-love, self-awareness, and self-healing online, on social media, in workshops and retreats, and as an adjunct professor for Columbia University Teachers College. And in addition to that, I started a podcast because I was over 337 pounds, and I had struggled with my weight my whole adult life, and with my relationship with my body and food for my entire life. And I had lost weight many times and gained it all back, and had completely decided not to ever do that again until the health consequences started to be very real as I got, you know, into my late 40s. So I decided that I had to figure it out. The emotional stuff, the medical, like sort of biological aspects of being overweight. And I thought, well, I'm a licensed counselor and I'm going to go on this journey to figure this out with medical experts, with counselors, with my friends and family. And I feel that I'm called to share what I learn with other people, because so many people are suffering in this way in the world and in our country. Just so many of our brothers and sisters are in pain with their weight. So those are the things. I also am a single mom to four amazing children who are going to bring wonderful gifts into the world.
That is a plate that is absolutely full. I was a single dad with four sons, so I understand some of that wonderful journey that goes as a single parent with so many children and all the benefits from that. One of the customs that we do here, Donk, is go back into that, as I mentioned to you, that time machine is called memory. And we revisit some of the areas that we reside shortly. And for a few years, the first space that we there is called family. And then we began to move and migrate into our life of independence, if you will. What was your family unit like?
Well, my mother got pregnant with me when she was 16 years old. And at that time in 1974, that was not acceptable. And, you know, still today we have a lot of shame around that sort of thing. And she ran off and married my dad, who was 19. They were very poor. They were probably never going to make a good couple. My mom, my family just came from a long line of, I mean, generations, which is something else we could talk about generational trauma that you're born with and that's put on you as a child. But generations of abuse, addiction, all terrible, terrible family problems that I was born into. And my mom had addiction as well. Thing that she did really right was that she got me away from the people in her family that caused her a lot of pain and abuse. So she did make some mistakes. She wasn't perfect. She loved me deeply. And she agreed to bring me into the world because she didn't have to, you know. So she did that and got me away from the worst of the abuse that I could have endured. So she set me up to have this life filled with challenges and some interesting foundational learning about what family is, what my value is. I felt like a burden. I felt like I was very annoying. I had all of my baby teeth were rotten, black. I felt ugly and like a nuisance. And so I set out to be perfect because I thought that if I behaved perfectly, if I was quiet, if I was nice, if I said all the right things and did all the right things, maybe everyone, you know, my family would be able to tolerate me better because they didn't have a high level of patience for me because they were children themselves. And, you know, but as a kid, any child, by the way, just developmentally, kids think everything is about them and their fault. So I took all that on, generations of abuse and trauma and addiction, and said, oh, this is me, and I'm tasked to fix it by being perfect. And so my whole personality was formed around this desire to people please and to produce results and to achieve and to be perfect. Thought maybe the sun would shine on me if I did that enough. And at 47, I realized, like, wait a minute, like, the peace, the happiness that I thought was going to come at the end of this perfection rainbow is just like, where is it? Like, what happened? Yeah. And so I had to seriously reevaluate my approach to life. And I radically changed physically, emotionally, spiritually, you know, in my mind, like all my thinking to fix all that.
How old were you when you took that on? That mindset that you had to take all of it. How old do you think you were?
Well, I have to guess because one of my earliest memories was my fifth birthday. I was it was my golden birthday, and my mother had left my father and left us with him, and they disagree about how long that was. She says like a month. He says like 6 months. Who knows? But my birthday was during that time, and my dad picked me up from school, and I didn't get any birthday presents. There was no birthday party. There was no friends. There were no singing or anything. What I got was a pair of Hostess cupcakes, the kind with the white swirly icing on top, you know, the packaged Hostess cupcakes. And I did not have to give one of those to my baby brother. I got to eat both of them. And I felt, it sounds like a sad story, but I was thrilled. I mean, thrilled. Yeah. Yeah. And so I know that by my fifth birthday, I already thought of food as my comfort. Mm-hmm. The day that my parents separated and they left was a memory shortly before that, where they were screaming at each other. They were pulling us in both directions. We were in the car, out of the car. It was like a fight about who was going to have us. And so there was physical pulling and all this. And I remember thinking, I have to do something. Like, this is what am I going to do to fix this? And I was 4 years old. And But what I know about that is that at 4 years old, it was already in there like an automatic response. It wasn't a new thought. So I think that I believe it was from day one that it began, and then it just built and built. Because as a kid, like sometimes, this plan of if I behave a certain way, I'll get what I need from my parents, it works some of the time, right? Like, so if as a kid, let's say I'm hot in the back seat of the car, and I have learned that it aggravates my mother if I complain about it, and I don't complain, so I don't, I'm hot, I'm sweaty, I don't say anything, and she's happy, I feel like, oh, it's success, like this is working. And so you keep going like that, and sometimes you're going to be wrong. You're going to do what you think is the right thing, and your mom will pinch you or hit you or smack you or verbally let you know that it wasn't right. And but sometimes you're right. It's enough to keep a kid going in that direction. So I think it was always.
That's powerful imagery that you just gave to us. I believe that as and I mentioned it on the onset, even before we're born, we are in that energy with mom and dad arguing, fighting, talking, making love, all of that. We are in it all. And we can sense a few things. And you'll see kids will come out energetically aware. Some of them are acutely aware of things. And some of them are dumb. They dumb it down. They choose to dumb it down, if you will. And it's all, I believe, from there in that womb, because we are there and absolutely collecting data every single second of our life and existence while we're there. So when we are born, we are born with some of those inclinations, if you will. As you said, you were 4 years old and you had that inclination that I need to make sure how to fix this and all this type of stuff, because you've been hearing them argue way before you were 4 years old.
That's right.
And so you were in the mix of it. So here you are, this young girl, acutely aware of this aspect of her having to please and making sure everything's done right. That's a tense place to be, and to always be restrictive in everything, your mindset, your behavior, body, all of it is just tied up. So here's this girl moving through life, if you will, and she's an older girl, high school. How is she relating to those that are outside? Because again, you have been programmed for certain things and respond a certain way. How did you relate to others outside of your family?
That's such a great question. Well, as I grew up, I was a kid at school who was nice to everyone. I went to a very tiny little school, and I was popular among the 20 kids that were in my class, so whatever that means. But I was well liked, and I was nice to everyone because that was my job, to people please and make everyone happy. And so I did that, and it was interesting because, and this is where I want to say my food relationship began too. It was in this relationship to others. So I said in the podcast that being fat was my apology to the world. And that comes from that kid who was at home. There was like chaos and arguments and unhappiness, right? At times. Of course, my family had normal days too, but there was this going on. And so I felt terrible, ugly, not valuable, like I was just wrong and bad. And then I go to school and I'm being perfect. So I'm getting lots of awards and I'm getting picked for things and elected by the kids to do things. And I felt really uncomfortable. Like the light is shining on me and people are going to see that I'm really not what they think I am. I'm not good. Underneath what they see is bad. And of course, I didn't realize this consciously, but now I know. Yeah, so well, and I'll go back to say my teeth were all black as a little kid. My baby teeth were black because of, it's called baby bottle mouth. When you fall asleep with the bottle in your mouth, or you're eating too much milk, or it's like sitting in your mouth and you're sucking on the thing for hours in the night. That's what, why that happens. And so my relationship to food as comfort started also, as a little tiny infant when I had nothing to do with it. So when I was a kid, there would be chaos in the home. I'm doing perfect at school. I'm feeling bad about who I am on the inside because of what's going on at home, I think is my fault. And when we would have dessert, you know, I would always try to get as much as possible. Like, I remember my relationship to sugar always being like this. And so I thought I was a fat person. Like, and I use that word, I reclaim the power of the word fat. It's not an insult in my mind because I was really big for a long time. And for me, I reclaim that word as mine. Mm-hmm. And fat is not a bad word. It's just something that's on my body, which is unimportant. So when I am having all of this going on, these sort of contradictions, right? Like, I'm getting, it was shameful to be so great, to have people think that I'm great was total. It still is. I got to be honest with you. That's something I struggle with. Like, here I am saying all these accomplishments, and on the inside, I'm thinking like, but I'm not that great. It's not as good as it sounds. Like, you should see how messy my bedroom is or whatever, you know, like it feels like you have to make yourself smaller. I feel like I have to make myself smaller and almost apologize for sounding so good and so threatening. So I think that one of the reasons that being so overweight benefited me was that it gave me this, it softened all of that. Like, other women wouldn't be threatened by me because no matter how many great things I did, I'm not a threat because I'm fat. You know, you don't have to worry. Yeah. You don't want to be me. You wouldn't want to trade with me. Men are not going to pay attention to me. And that also is not true. But these are false things, that these lines of thinking that we're not even realizing we're giving ourselves this kind of talk. But that's what was going on in me. It was like my way of saying, you can tolerate me. It's okay. You know, look at my body. I'm not great, you know? And as a kid and as a teenager, I was still just in the mode, completely unaware of all of this, completely in the mode of people pleasing and perfectionism. So I've always been a very loyal person. I still have the same best friends that I've had since I was in high school, plus new ones that I've kept for 20, 30 years. So I keep very deep friendships. I'm very, very blessed in that way that I've been, I've had this chosen family, that gives me the support that I need and the love that I need. And ultimately though, I learned that I had to give it to myself. A lot of you, when you said how was I relating to other people, one of the things that I was compelled to share was that I often would put up roadblocks for people that loved me and tests, like, will you still love me if I throw a fit about this? Will you, are you sure you love me? Because do you love me enough to come with me to do this really, you know, strenuous thing that I need you to help me with? Are you going to help me move? You know, like, I feel like I was constantly forcing the people that I loved to prove it to me that they loved me too, because I just couldn't believe, you know, that I was lovable. And so that had to be fixed as well, had to be addressed, had to be healed. And it really all begins with giving that love to yourself.
Yeah. Let me ask you this question, because here's this young girl. And I mean, we are all storytellers, and the stories that we tell each other and tell ourselves basically will, you know, later the road for our life. And I get the part about the weight and all that stuff, but why did you feel that you had to be that way, in the sense, because you said if you're that way fat, that, you know, everything. What was it that made you make that decision? Was it what happened to this young girl that made her say, that's the route that I want to take?
I think it's a combination of things. Also, very good question. I think the first thing is that food is what I had access to. You know, when I was a little kid and growing up, I didn't have car keys and money to go buy whatever I wanted. I couldn't go out and get drugs. You know, I wasn't drinking alcohol. That's not the route I went. So that was what was at home, and that's what was giving me the dopamine hits that I needed. So food, my food relationship kind of, I think, was the foundation of that. And then also, all of us, every single one of us, is born into this extremely fat phobic society, especially in the 1970s and before. And, you know, even since to this day, we are programmed to believe that people who are thin are more valuable. That's just what you see everywhere. And so, and there was some, you know, fat phobia in my home. There was definitely, like, my mom had internalized fat phobia. She definitely felt like she needed to be thin and was trying to be thin. When she gained weight, she felt bad about herself, and there was things mentioned in the home about that. You know, she was made fun of or whatever. So I think I saw firsthand, and also it just was programmed like everybody else to believe that thinness was like the ultimate goal. And I never felt like I was thin, because I think I felt bad. I felt bad. So I must be fat because people don't, you know, I'm not getting what I need and I'm bad. And so maybe just being fat is a part of that. And so I think it just happened. Again, none of this was conscious. I just only now, like you said, I can go back and give it this story because it's what I feel from my heart is true, and was true for me then. But at the time, I was just trying to feel my way, trying to survive. You know, I was surviving a difficult circumstance, at times difficult.
And as this young girl is moving through life, heading into college, because you do have several year degrees and all that stuff, and you did say that she was, pretty smart kid in school and accomplished in there. When you're heading, looking into your future, why did you pick the field that you did? What was that situation that caused you to say, that's where I'm going to go?
Yes. Gosh, that's a great question. I keep saying that. You do ask great questions.
Oh, thank you.
Well, first I want to say that my main thing from the time I hit puberty, all I could think about was becoming a mother. I knew that I was going to be a mom, and I was going to be the best mom, and my kids were going to be so awesome, and they were going to love me so much, and I was going to have a family. And so I got married at 21, had my first kid at 24. Like, so I was getting my education, but the main, and I was literally, I remember as early as 11 or 12 years old thinking, I need to get good grades so that I can go to college, so that I can make good money and be a good mom to my children. Like, everything I've done in my life since I was old enough to think a thought has been for my kids long before they were ever born, because I wanted a home that had what I didn't have. And of course, it doesn't work that way. You know, no, I was definitely not the perfect mother, although my children are amazing and they're adults now. Three of them are. Anyway, but you asked why I went into this field. And I'll say, if you asked me when I was a little girl, what do you want to do when you grow up? I would say, I want to help people. That was always my answer. I want to help people. And so when I went into college, I wasn't sure exactly what I was going to do, but I ended up getting general studies with a focus on counseling. And then over time, I ended up going back for my master's in counseling, and that's what I decided. And when I had to choose an internship site, they gave me a list of all the approved sites, and I literally started with the A and went all the way down and called like 10 of them. And I just went with the first one to call me back, which was an addiction treatment facility for indigent women who couldn't afford to pay for their treatment. And I fell in love and completely changed as a person as a result of working with those women. That is absolutely, I have the chills. This is my truth. It was a turning point in my life. And those women, I owe them a gift they could never repay me. For showing me who I am, and my place in the world, because I absolutely felt like I was home, that that's where it was. But I didn't even realize at the time that I came from a long line of women who had addiction, and that I myself was in addiction to food. And I didn't put all this together. I just knew that my heart and my passion were in this and that I was helping. And it took me a long time to turn that around onto myself and shine the light here and say, wait, whoa, what help do I need?
So yeah. As you were working with these women, because here you are wounded and you have wounded women coming and in pain, you're in pain as well. And you said that they saved your life and they helped you, you know, felt at home. Being in pain and dealing and serving in pain, what was happening to you, Doc, as an individual? There you are, this girl that has been through so much and feels safe within food. And you're coming with these women, again, broken, damaged, or whatever the terms we use. And you are just like them. How did you feel? How did you manage that? Because you're now encouraging them, but from a place that is broken. How was that?
So I think, as you have said, I've heard you say that your trauma is your superpower. I think that's where that comes in for me. First of all, I learned that it was like an eye-opening experience because these women experienced trauma that I had never gotten close to. To be a person that is in and out of addiction treatment, in and out of jail, having multiple cases of trauma inflicted, violence and trauma inflicted upon them, that is not, I had a difficult circumstances here and there, you know, there were some challenges that for me were very real and it's all relative, but they showed me like that people are coming from backgrounds and perspectives that I know nothing about. So, my compassion though was always the leader because I knew how I had felt, what I had gone through, and that, and ultimately my compassion for other people was the thing that I think made me good at what I did, and it made me know that I was good at it, was that I always came from a place of love and acceptance, no matter what. Because some, like, I'll just very briefly tell you, like, one example, I worked with a woman in the group who had been, I don't know, I don't want to use too strong a words, but let's say her mother had sold her. And everyone in the group was very upset for this woman, very much compassion for her. 6 months later, the girl's mother comes into treatment. All the same women are still there. And I had to help guide, I had to help guide them through developing compassion for the mother of their friend who had done this to her as a kid. And that was a test for all of us. But like, if you don't, if you can't have compassion for someone like that, then you can't be a helper. And that's okay. Not everyone in the world is meant to be a helper. Some of us have to work other parts of the system, you know, for humanity to progress. But that was like one of those things and taught me that compassion is the absolute base of inner peace too. Compassion for others is more for you than it is for them. Because if you have to sit next to this lady in your addiction treatment group, you need peace on your inside, and her compassion for her is what can give you that. She might not ever know that you had compassion, but so I think compassion is the key, and being relating my experience, however mild mine was by comparison. I think that's a superpower, you know?
Yeah, it is. I think it becomes the superpower. It is the tool by which we, as the first part of it, is how we are brutalized, if you will. And then we turn it in. We have the opportunity. Some of those we have an opportunity to choose to use it as a superpower. And some people just like their pain. And so you have others that just comfortable where they're at, and it's okay to learn how to have compassionate detachment, I call it, where you learn mm-hmm. to love them from a distance and you don't allow them to come in, if you will, because of their decision, because you're seeing that. And so that compassionate detachment is a powerful lesson to learn, especially when you're compassionate and you want to save someone, as you always want. We want to do with people pleasers, you know, so it can drive you nuts, especially as a parent with children. So here you are, Dom. You're dealing with all these wonderful, powerful women and being as they are going through theirs and so forth, and you're moving through your life. And at what point in your life did things begin to crash and burn, if you will? Because you got to come to the place where you're now going to begin to face yourself. And I remember I was going through my divorce, and I was working at a skilled nursing facility. And those people in the skilled nursing facility made me a man. I was broken into pieces from the divorce. I am dressed in the suit. And I remember walking the hallways, and I would engage with everyone in that skilled nursing facility. And so they all knew me. And they taught me so much that I recognized that they were even more in pain than I was, and that I had to learn how to serve in pain. That is why I ask you that question. Mm-hmm. I had to learn how to put aside my pain for a while and serve, and so that I can help that individual to alleviate some of theirs. And then I would go back in the hallways dealing with my pain. And so they taught me much. And so that's why I ask you, because in my case, I crashed and burned. I had to learn how to love me and how to forgive and all the different less than thoughts that I was walking the hallway with and guiding my day through. What was your situation that brought you to the place where you had to face you? No.
So I'll say that it all started with, I've always been very intuitive. I've always felt a very close connection to my source. I've felt guided and protected, and like there was a purpose for me. And at some point, I think around 46 years old or so, I felt a calling to host a woman's retreat. And I thought, well, I don't know anything. What am I going to talk about? I'm not an expert at anything. Like, what? I don't even know what to say at this thing. Yeah. So I started asking my friends, like, what women, what are you dealing with? Like, what could we talk about? And what emerged was the inner critic. And I was like, oh yeah, I don't think I have that really. let me look at this, you know? And so I started tuning in to my own thoughts, the way that I was talking to myself. And I realized, like, oh dang, like this witch has been running the show. and she's mean. And I didn't even know I was doing this to myself, but like, I'll say my inner critic used to love to say, who do you think you are?
Wow.
That was all of that shame about getting awards or election, you know, being elected or picked at school or getting straight A's or whatever, was because of, who do you think you are? You're not great. Mm-hmm. You're nobody's going to want to listen to what you have to say. And so then I was like, shoot, like I've always been a problem solver.
Yeah.
So I immediately thought, okay, well, I have to fix mine. And then again, similar to with the podcast, I thought, well, if I'm going to fix mine, I may as well be, I must need to share this because other people have this too. So I began, literally while my inner critic was still beating me up, I began researching the inner critic, developing tools to heal the inner critic. And I started putting out videos on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook about healing the inner critic. And as I'm literally building the plane as I'm flying it. And I still do that because teaching helps me learn. But as it has evolved. The inner critic, I've been able to quiet that, or when I do hear it, I recognize and like, ah, oh, there you are again. Yeah. You know, you're not important to me. We're not going to listen to that right now. But what I realized that quieting the inner critic opened the door for self-love. And I thought, oh gosh, I don't love myself either. You know, then you realize, well, I got to figure that out. And so then I began developing tools to develop a self-love practice. And that is what I teach now. And as I've enriched my self-love practice, I've realized that that opens the door and clears that channel between you and your source. If you have self-love, your relationships to others improve. And your clarity around your purpose in life and your connection to who you really are is then available to you. When you're running around still under the influence of your brain, which is just an organ like any other brain in your body, it's just trying to keep you alive. Like, that doesn't care if you're happy, it doesn't care if you're at peace. Yeah. It just wants you alive, breathing.
Yeah.
And the brain likes to be busy, so it's going to have you thinking a lot. And negativity tends to wrap us up more. So it's like, yeah, that's good. That's keeping her real busy. I'm going to keep that up. So when you're ruled by that, you are not as clear or as quiet or as at rest. You can't hear the guidance that is always coming from whatever you believe it to be. God, the source, you know, whatever your connection is, the universe. Once you love yourself, and you're not being ruled by the stinking thinking, as some people say, then you can hear what's being offered to you in the way of ways out of problems. Like right now, yeah. I had a little conflict with someone that I love very much. And in my mind, she did the wrong thing. Like, she was acting out on me about something that has to do with her. And in the past, I would have been reactive and said, well, I can't believe you did that. Why would you do that? That was wrong. You were wrong and I'm right. And now I say, oh, I have compassion for you because I love you and I know you love me. And I know you must be in pain to have done that.
Yeah.
That's where you want to be. But without like that self-love and that connection to the source, because I didn't just think of that on my own. My guidance gave me that, like, oh, just give her compassion. Oh, yeah. Well, that's easy to do. I love her, so I can do that. But if I had been ruled by my own ego, my own like chitter chatter about the negativity and bogged down in the story of what happened, I can't even hear that guidance. I'm not even in touch with it. But I want to say clearly that not having self-love is not our fault. That's like the current state of like just being human. And people aren't running around teaching us this either. So it's not something that we're born with. Well, maybe we're born with it and then being alive takes it away from us, but it's not something that we grow up with automatically.
Yeah, the programmers don't want us to love ourselves, because absolutely if we love ourselves, the world will change. Because the principle is to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy mind. Then you have to love your neighbor as yourself. So if you don't love yourself, when you learn about you from your God, and as you love yourself from that relationship, and then when you look on the outside, you can love that individual. But if you are listening to that witch, as you said,
I'm using the nice words.
Yeah, as you're listening to that witch in all of our. Our minds, we'll never be able to get to where we need to. So what were some of those tools, Doc, did you bring into your space to begin to deal with that witch?
So the automatic inclination to negative thoughts that make us feel bad about ourselves, is to run away from them. We just want to shut it down, like, oh, I mean, like I said, I wasn't even aware that I was doing this because I was so accustomed to tuning it out, turning away from it, and instead having a pint of Ben and Jerry's to cover over it, because the dopamine that you get from that makes you feel good and you can forget about what the witch is saying.
Yeah.
So what we have to do is counterintuitive. We have to turn around and look in a mirror, face ourselves, and listen. Just listen with compassion and say, wow, like, That's a lot that I'm saying to myself. My inner critic is saying that I'm ugly or not worthy or whatever it is. You know, in my case, who do you think you are? Which always kept me dimming my light. So tuning into it is the first step, and realizing that it doesn't have power over you, that your thoughts are not facts, that just because you're saying to yourself that someone hates you doesn't mean they hate you, for example. Mm-hmm. Or just because you're saying to yourself that no one wants to hear what you have to say, or that you're going to fail at this, doesn't make it true. That your thoughts are just literally impulses created by an organ in your body, just like lungs and kidneys and liver, you know, those, they're just doing their job. It's not like some, your brain is not who you are. It's an organ in your body. So recognizing that. And then I did develop a few specific tools. Like, for example, you can let your best friend's voice tackle your inner critic for you. Like, so let's say your inner critic peeks in and says, you're too fat to wear that bikini. What would your best friend say to someone who said that to you? So you can literally in your mind, imagine your best friend's voice having a conversation back to your inner critic. Your best friend might say, well, that's ridiculous. You're beautiful and you can wear whatever you want, and it's not about other people. And so you just listen and let the rationale sink in, like, because you're confronting the illogical, because it's often very illogical. It doesn't even make, everybody hates you. Like, what kind of thinking is that? Like, really everyone, you know, like there's a lot of illogic and like backwards thinking. Like, a lot of times we think we're psychic and we know what another person is thinking about us. And you're, best friend would say, well, you have no idea what they think, and who cares what they think. So that's one tool that I really like. And then also just confronting the logic yourself. These are just a couple of things with this inner critic. And then with developing a self-love practice, I love this movement around self-love. There's a lot of talking about it right now. I think it's still greatly misunderstood. The, you know, Miley Cyrus song, like, I can buy myself flowers, I can hold my own hand. That's wonderful. And yes, like, I do buy myself flowers as a part of my self-love practice. But self-love really means loving all the parts of you, the human parts. You know, one new tool that I've developed is when I'm not at my best, like, let's say I'm in a long line and the cashier does something that's unfair and I get sassy with her. You know, something happens like where she's not doing the right thing and I'm right and she's wrong, and I'm human and I'm impatient and I've been dealing with the frustration of being in this line. And then I walk away from that and I go, dang, you could have handled that better. Like, you were a jerk, you know. I might, and I have and do, go back and apologize. I'll say, I've had a moment to rest from the situation. I just want to tell you, you didn't deserve that. I'm really sorry for being impatient with you. And they're often very surprised, not that this happens all the time, but I do, I will do that to give myself peace and also to spread kindness. And then even more so, I say to myself, your humanity was showing. It's okay. You're human. You were frustrated. That's what humans do when they're frustrated. So to forgive and to allow myself to be human, that is self-love. It's not that I'm going to be perfect. It's not that I'm going to always be this Zen, perfect person walking around spreading love and kindness and, you know, every moment of the day. I won't, because I'm human. Yeah. And this is a human experience. And so I think making space for what we deem to be our faults and our imperfections and loving ourselves in spite of those, that is self-love. Being loving myself enough to quit expecting perfection. To quit putting all of my energy into pleasing other people so that they'll approve of me and love me. That is self-love.
How did you, because this girl is not familiar at all with boundaries when from her journey. Self-love has degrees where one must introduce boundaries within the process of loving the self. When you recognize, and you knew that you didn't have it, when you recognize that you needed to start implementing boundaries, how did that come about?
So, Ken, I think this is where people get stuck, and this is where I was stuck. I think I was smart enough to recognize that everything wasn't perfect, that I wasn't healed. You know, I knew when I was in my 20s working with these women who were in addiction treatment that my food relationship was similar to their relationship with drugs. I knew that. But I couldn't go there because recognizing it meant I had to make changes, including setting boundaries. And that was terrifying. If you think about a person, a girl who spent her whole life deriving her value from other people's assessment of her, and you're telling her that what she needs to do to have peace is to like set boundaries and quit working overtime to make everyone else happy, like, no way, how am I going to be valuable? How am I going to have any self-worth? So I think that is where I was stuck for so long. And once I opened this door and started looking at the inner critic and self-love, I was like, oh crap. Like, for one thing, like I was in a primary relationship for 5 years, a live-in partnership with a man that, gosh, he loved me so much. He still loves me so much, and I love him, but he was not evolved to the point where he could have any tolerance for my feelings at all. It was very much like my childhood situation. There was no room for me to complain or have feelings or be upset about anything at all. And so it was at times a bit emotionally abusive, if I'm honest. And I knew immediately, as soon as I started peeling back these layers, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to have to end this relationship. And the decision that I made was, okay, but I don't have to do it right now. I know that I will have the strength to do what I need to do when the time comes. I'm not ready yet. But that does not mean that I have to stop healing or learning about myself. I can, deep breath, put one step in front of the other. Just learning the truth about my life does not mean that I have to make drastic changes. Like the day you realize that your marriage is not good for you don't have to file paperwork. Because I think we, and this happens with my clients as well, because I help them uncover the truth about their life, and then they start to see the mountain that they're going to have to climb to change the relationships that they're in. And they're like, no. You know, but what I say is you build those muscles over time. Like it doesn't mean you have, just don't stop. Don't stop. Like I had to just say, okay, like I have a feeling that this relationship is not going to make it past another 6 or 9 months. And I was right about that. But when I ended the relationship, I was really ready to do it. I had built up the tools and the self-love to comfort myself. You don't just realize it when you realize you don't have self-love and that you've gotten yourself into relationships that don't have good boundaries. It's not a good idea to dive in and set the boundaries, make changes immediately. Like you want to build those muscles first. That's like the first day you start weightlifting, you don't go out and like try and pick up your car in the driveway. You're gonna break your back, you know? You don't do that. You just need to breathe, understand that realizing these things in your heart, in your soul, and in your mind doesn't mean that today you have to fix everything. Because I also was very much always moving at the speed of the light to fix, fix, fix. And so for me, that was a real lesson. And setting boundaries has meant that I've, you know, some people have had to change how they relate with me. And I've chosen to not be as engaged with some people as I was before, or to change the nature of relationships. But so far, it has all been a positive thing for me, for sure.
Yeah, it is always a positive thing to become one that is setting appropriate boundaries, because outside of that, you become burnout, you become all of the different things. As someone who has encountered burnout, is because they haven't set boundaries. And so now, how I, as a father with four, single dad with four boys, I had to learn how to set boundaries for my boys because I love them. I would die for them a million times a minute for them because I love them so much. But my kids knew, especially when I did my meditation, they knew that when I was in that state of meditation, that no one would interrupt my time. And I would have friends that will come and visit, and I would be in my meditation, and they would tell them, don't even try. I mean, they would protect my space because they knew that it was my time and it was precious for me. And I also taught them about meditation, the value of it. But they understood that when Dad is there in that space, that's his space. And they never entertain interrupting my time. So yeah, I had to learn boundary setting because I also was a people pleaser from a trauma that I endured as a young boy, that I wanted to make sure that that doesn't happen again to me. So I'll do the best I can to please everyone. And in that state, create more problems than anything else. I swear to God.
That's right. It's never a good plan. It's never a good plan.
Really, because you come out so abused out of all of that, because people interpret that as weakness and they abuse you. And so you're always in this perpetual trauma because you're not setting boundaries, and boundaries will protect you from trauma. So here you are, dog. Learning things. You recognize that where your location with this gentleman is harmful to your personal development and your process of loving yourself. And as you grew more and more now, and I know that you had, and I'm going to provide everything for you guys to get access to her podcast and the Instagram and all that stuff, because you guys need to get there. Is some fascinating stuff that they talk about. Dom opens up and goes in deeper than what we're having this conversation. And she has actually, in those podcasts and the Instagram, she has basically just filleted herself in front of us for us to look at her and inspect. So I'll provide all of that stuff for you guys to get access to her. So here, Dom, here you have, you begin to see you. And it all stemmed from having this women's seminar. As you are being filleted and learning and all of these things, what was happening with all of that stuff? Because now you going through, people call it the dark, something of the soul, but
dark night
it's
of
just
the soul.
The dark night of the soul. But here it is, this woman, mom, and everything, seeing herself, and you put the word out now that you want to have this conference. Talk to me, what happened?
It was really wonderful, and I've done a few now. But at the time, I was still like, if you look at the photo from the first day, I was still over 300 pounds. Yeah. And so one of the things that came out of learning to love myself is that a cornerstone of self-love is being honest with yourself, which I had refused to do, I think, for most of my life. I had really sidestepped thinking about the consequences of my size. I had embraced body positivity. Like, here I am, I'm beautiful, I love my curves. So I was experiencing all of this growth, this self-love, growth. And that was another thing that became apparent, like, oh goodness, I'm gonna have to address how I treat my body as a part of my self-love. Like, that was another thing. It was like, what do I do? You know, because I've tried a million times to lose weight. So what I've discovered is that really the best way to lose weight is to stop trying to lose weight. Yeah. The idea is, what do I need to do to take care of myself? And so that meant ending a 5-year partnership. That meant going to see doctors about what to do about my health. That meant going to see coaches and therapists and being very honest with myself about how I was moving through the world. You mentioned kids, and I'll say, like, I was so fortunate. My relationship with my children is, they're like such light beings. They're so, like, my oldest son taught me about the value of meditation. He's an incredible teacher. My children have been incredible teachers, and mirrors for me.
Yeah,
But
mine as well.
yeah, and aren't they all though, really? They show us who we
Yeah.
are at our best and worst.
Not really.
But so I always had them as my anchor, and from there, just doing this, it was painful but also liberating. And I'll say, I always felt so protected and connected with my source, whatever that is. And I don't have all the answers, but I do know there's something that unites us all, that all living beings are connected, that this we have this illusion that we're alone and struggling in the world on our own, and none of that is true. And to come to that acceptance is so freeing, because no matter what thing you think, this mountain you have to climb, whether it's losing 170 pounds, 75 pounds, as I have done, or stopping drinking, or going back to school, or whatever it is, breaking up with in a relationship that's not good for you, whatever those challenges are, you're not alone. And that if you feel in your gut this calling to do it, and you've cleared the way by diminishing these thoughts that keep us from feeling that, then you feel with each step you take, as painful as it might be, or scary even, that you're gonna be okay. That's the thing. Like, I don't think I could do it without a spiritual practice, without my meditation practice, without, all of this. I feel like this mind, body, spirit thing that everyone talks about, it's so real. Like, you really got to get the mind in check. The spirit has to be clear and open, and you have to be taking care of your body. And that doesn't just mean, like, right now, I've lost 175 pounds. Like, I've got the flabby skin on my belly, and I've got these nice toned arms with the skin flapping around on the underneath side. I have to love and accept my body. I feel like I look 10 years older. I still love and accept my body. Just at 337 pounds, I loved and accepted my body, and now I do too. And it's not any easier, because as humans, we are self-critical. We are feeling like we're not enough, going out into the world, feeling like our body matters so much, and what we look like, and all that. It's just our programming, as you so aptly put it. And so getting in touch with that spirit side is just critical. Like, I can't say enough. For me, it's that mind, body, spirit connection, and moving all of these pieces at the same time that makes me know that I will never turn my back on myself again. I will never be 300 pounds again, because I will never turn my back on myself, because I'm honest with myself about the consequences of that, and I won't allow it. That I can trust myself to take care of me. So
That is
it was painful being flayed and like vulnerable, but also that's who I am and what I've always been called to do, and felt protected while I did it.
Yeah, I think it's good because it allows others to see that you're real and that you're tangible. Because a lot of people are not exposed to that honesty. And as you state, you have to be honest with yourself, and you have to face yourself. And when I began to face myself is when I started to see results, because I had to learn to love me. And that was very difficult because I had to face me. I had to go sit down and talk with him and engage with him and embark in a conversation. And I would actually sit down and talk of it with myself, and all the different fears and things that will come up. I would sit down and say, okay, where is that coming from? Why? Let's journey back. And we would journey and see where it happened and say, oh wow. And I had to learn how to encourage him when we recognize where it was and say, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay, and so forth. So those are the kind of conversation you'll have with yourself. And as you learn to have those conversations, you're learning to respect, honor, and all of these things. I've dealt with people and from conversations so much, and because we deal with negative thinking and how we process. When someone say diet to me, it seems of a limitation of things. And I tell people, don't embark on diets, embark on lifestyle change. When you put it in as a diet, you seem as if you have a short amount of space to accomplish damage or whatever you've done in your body for 40, 50 years or 30 years, whatever that is, you want to finish it done in, they tell you, 3 months. And if you don't see anything drop down to this slender thing that you have in your head, where your abs and then your gut and everything is showing perfectly, you have failed. Why? Because you have already painted a picture of limitation when you say diet.
Yes.
I tell people, you're not dieting. You're learning to make a lifestyle change. You're learning mm-hmm. to honor you. As you look at it that way, you allow yourself, when you sneak around a corner, you have that extra spoon of ice cream, you're okay. You tell us that, okay, you can't do this again. And you're kinder to you. You're not under that bondage of trying to finish and get it done within. You allow yourself the time where it can take you 6 months, a year, and you're not bent out of shape. And in all that time, you're getting yourself accomplished. Your lifestyle has changed, meaning that your mindset, that's how you change your lifestyle, your mindset. You're allowing yourself the time instead of the limitation with diet. So I tell people, don't go on diets. You'll never make it. It's all cutting out all the good stuff with you because I've trained myself though. I've trained myself. I have, as I told you, some of my vices. Cheesecake, oh my God, I still have that. And so I would go to a store and I'd buy a slice of cheesecake. And I can have a small piece of that cheesecake and put it back. And I'm not going to touch that cheesecake. Whereas before, I would have finished that, gone back to the store and see if we could get a whole cheesecake. Before, you know, instead of this slice stuff, you know, and so you have to learn all of these different things and boundaries, as I said, it will save your life. And so I could have a spoonful of ice cream, one spoon, and I'm okay. I'm not going to lose it. I'm not going to stab anyone because my mother, Doc, when she was pregnant, she ate chocolate. That was her thing. And I will have a chocolate craze like once in a couple of years that I will kill anyone in my way that is stopping me from going to get my chocolate. And I had to learn how to deal with that. But like you said, you know, we get that. My mother was eating chocolate with my sister was something else. And my sister, we talked about it a few days ago, M&M's. And that poor lady, when she gets into that craze and she has to have those M&Ms, you know, she turned in like me too. So it's things that happen because of decisions that happen in our family and so forth. Yeah. But it's our responsibility. Yeah, it's our responsibility to deal with it, to change the mindset of the family, of the lineage, of the bloodline. Every family has an opportunity where an individual can be the change that is needed in that bloodline. And here you are, Doc. You're doing your show. You're out there. You're still heavy. And you're, what was it that catalyst that as you're gaining love, you're loving yourself and all this thing, but that catalyst that when you looked in that mirror and go, that's not me. We need to work on that.
Yes.
What happened because you're in the midst of still doing things with ladies, all the different events? What was it that caused you to say enough?
So the first thing was that I allowed myself, like I said, I knew that part of self-love is being honest. So I allowed myself to watch a documentary. I think it's on HBO. I can't, or maybe Netflix. I can't remember. And it's called The Weight of the Nation. And it let me see, I finally faced and like allowed myself to absorb the risk factors, the health problems that I was facing being 337 pounds, like 13 different types of cancer. You're at a higher risk for, you have 13-year life expectancy reduction when you're obese, things like that, that I had never wanted to see or hear. I allowed myself to think about those things. And then I was talking to a friend of mine. At the time, my grandmother was very sick and in the hospital. And at the time, she was 90, maybe 91. Now she's 94, and I still stay with her in the hospital when she goes. But I had been helping to take care of her. And I told my friend, I said, my grandmother's not particularly, she's a little overweight, but not much. But she's really not mobile. She can't get herself in and out of bed and the car very easily or any of that. And I said to my friend, I said, I don't want to be 90 something years old and unable to get in and out of the car. And with the most love, she looked at me and she said, nobody your size is 90 years old. Yeah. And that was very brave of her to do. And I would caution people about, if you're going to talk to a person who's overweight about your concerns, realize that in that conversation, I brought it up to her. She didn't bring it up to me. So that's important. Like, it's very, almost never a good idea for you to bring it up to someone you're concerned about. I know that's like another topic, but that was a moment where I said, okay, well, what do I really want? I want to be around for my children and grandchildren, and I want to meet some of the greats too. So, you know, I want to live and I got to do this. And I want to talk to you about, well, so to go back a half a step about the conversation with yourself, I just wanted to give this tool to your listeners that one of the things that is so helpful to me when you're having a strong reaction to something, when you feel emotional or uncharacteristically angry all of a sudden at something someone does or says or whatever, ask yourself, what are you ashamed of or afraid of? Because almost always these strong reactions that we have are clues. They're like showing us where the healing opportunities are. So I just want to give that tool. And then about diet, I think it's also really important. Like for me, I do not restrict anything. I focus on what I'm supposed to eat, not what I'm not supposed to eat. So I make sure to get enough protein every day because I really care about building muscle. I'm really focused on like my yoga practice. I want to get more flexible and balanced and strong. So for me, I need enough protein. And so getting enough protein automatically eliminates a lot of the sugar and carbs and things that make us gain weight. And I also do a philosophy called eat what you want and add what you need. So if you're craving M&Ms, you can have some M&Ms. Put them on a plate with your lunch. Like put a healthy, balanced meal that includes like an apple, you know, that gives you some fiber and it's a high protein chicken breast, you know, and then something, say, that's like some avocado that has healthy fats or whatever you put together as a balanced, satisfying meal, and put some M&Ms, one serving, on that plate with it. Mm-hmm. Then you're not, first of all, if you eat a whole handful of M&Ms without other food, what you're going to get from that is a ton of craving for more M&Ms. Because you are not satisfied, you are not full, and your body craves what you give it. But if some M&Ms are mixed in with this beautiful, balanced, healthy, nutritious meal, you're slowing things down and your body is not reacting to the sugar in the same way. So that's a really important little tool for me that's helped me have success. But taking care of yourself and falling in love with the process and not thinking only about the end goal, because something that is a goal that's 6 months away, a year away, or for me, a year and a half away, that is hard to be successful with if that's all. You have to think of it as a success each and every day.
Every day.
To make a good choice for yourself.
Yeah. And as you began to do that and you began to, you saw that as your, the genesis for you beginning to move and compel you to move on. How did the book came about? How did you give birth to that? Because as you're going through this journey and you're gaining knowledge, you're out there pulling from all over your, and again, guys, you have to go and listen to the podcast and it'll bring you in and give you some other clues as to what went on and stuff like that. As you are doing all of this and you are there, how did the book came about where you're going to say, this is what I'm going to write about, and the title? How did the title come about?
Well, I'm in the process of writing my book now, and it is yet untitled. the podcast title was born because there's this stigma around, even just yesterday, I went to a doctor appointment and the nurse seemed just enamored with me. She kept commenting on how beautiful I was, how young I look. I mean, sometimes people make you a little uncomfortable. It's like, it's strange. It was weird. And I had mentioned that I had lost 174 pounds to the doctor, and she's sitting there taking the notes for him. And she goes, "Oh, did you do that on your own?" And I said to her, "Oh, is there another way?" I didn't know there was an option for someone to do it for me. It's like, yeah, I did it. I did it. Every pound by myself. And she's like, "Oh, I meant like, did you have surgery?" And I said, "Well, I lost 100 pounds and then I had bariatric surgery. So yeah, I did have surgery," because there's this stigma around having the surgery. And this is what I explore in the podcast. I originally started the podcast to say, should I or shouldn't I have bariatric surgery? Should I have gastric bypass? And a lot of it is there's this stigma around having the surgery. Like, then you somehow don't get credit for the work, or that it was easy. But, you know, and I knew this before, but I could tell you for sure, having gastric bypass is not easy. They're literally rerouting your plumbing. Like, everything about the way you eat, go to the bathroom, like everything, digest food, all changes. It's like you're a baby again, learning how to eat solid food. And you also, after gastric bypass, can still eat and gain weight, and people do. You have to figure out these other elements, that mind, body, spirit thing. It's gastric bypass has been a very good tool for me. I was using GLP-1 medication. That has been a very good tool for me. But in my mind, I am certain that even with those tools, if I didn't figure out the mind, the emotional part, my spiritual connection, I would be back where I started. I have no doubt about it, because those tools are not going to save you from yourself. Yeah. If you have a food addiction, they're not going to save you from that. And they might help, and they might help temporarily, or maybe they'll help in the long term for some people. But in my mind, like you've said many times, you have to face yourself. And I had to get way deeper than just have surgery or not. But the easy way out, it's what people call it, that if you have surgery, it's the easy way out. And I can guarantee you that it is not the easy way. I wouldn't recommend anyone having surgery as a first option if they're overweight. Like, that should be your last resort, because it is serious. It's a very serious change. Right now, the doctors have told me to stop losing weight. And I'm like, shoot, like, I don't know how to do that exactly. Because I can't undo the gastric bypass. Like, it's over. It's, you know, not reversible. So that's why I called it that. It was a play on words. It's the easy way out, W-E-I-G-H. And my book is going to be broader. The book is, I was guided to revisit all of my spiritual and emotional teachers. So I'll show you. I have on my desk all of the books from my, that I feel were turning points for me and cornerstones in my learning about emotional health, spiritual health. Like, how did I come to believe and know what I believe and know about people and our spirituality and our emotional health? And so I'm revisiting Eckhart Tolle and Wayne Dyer and even Brené Brown and Oprah Winfrey. Like, I'm going to take my teachers and put that into something for people. And as you said, and this is very important, and I think this is my superpower, that I'm a real person. A lot of people will lose a lot of weight and come back and say, "Oh, this is how I did it, and this is what you need to do." But I let people in while I was still in the midst of the shame, while I was still carrying around 100 extra pounds, while I didn't know what to do, you know, while I was figuring it out. And the book is going to be from the same perspective. Like, here I am trying to figure it out, and I want you to come with me, and you can figure it out with me. And that's going to be the goal. And I definitely will keep you posted when it's finished.
Awesome. Excellent. And all of you that have been listening to us about this beautiful conversation and her life, and Doc has been very open with us, and we just want to say thank you. And We will provide everything so that you guys will get access. I'm telling you, you've got to go on that journey. I'm going to make sure you have everything. And when the book comes out, let us know. We'll announce it on our platforms as well so that others can be able to have access to it so that they can see. Because you're such a, you're the real thing. Guys, she's the real thing. And all of you that are going through your thoughts, you know, I know people that have had the surgery, the bypass surgery and the gastric surgery and gain weight because the mind had not, was not dealt with and the individual hadn't gone in to discover why and how and began to excavate those things. You've got to face self. So I know here is someone that has faced self and came out, and she knows some of those conversations that you're having inside of you because she's had them. And she knows the answers. She knows what to say to that hurting individual to hold her up or him up as you are walking through your process of changing your mind, which will change your lifestyle.
Thank you for this amazing conversation. I have thoroughly enjoyed getting to know you and talking with you.
Thank you so much.